Now, you've been kind of lucky in that your earlier works, the five novels previous to Kingdom of Shadows, have all in the past year and a half been reissued in trade paperback. And I've been slowly working my way through them. And we began by talking about a book that came out several years ago, again, available right now in trade paper, called The World at Night and its sequel, Red Gold. And I mentioned that The World at Night was very different from Kingdom of Shadows, Blood of Victory, and The Polish Officer, because it takes place in Paris, and you know Paris.
Yes, well, I lived there for a long time. I didn't intend to have Red Gold, in fact, be a sequel to The World at Night. The opening quote in Red Gold is from Victor Serge, and what I wanted to do with that book is have a Victor Serge character, which is to say the 1940 Trotskyite, bruised, battered, loathed, driven from Spain, driven here, driven there, no country to go to, and he was to be the central character. But The World at Night was in a number of ways as successful, not so much as Kingdom of Shadows, but it was quite successful and quite well-reviewed. And there was some feeling at my publisher that the lead character, Jean Casson, who was a French film producer, was a good character and maybe ought to reappear. And so I tried it, and then in the end I was not entirely happy that I'd done it. But that book gave me trouble anyhow. I think every writer in their career has a book that gives them trouble. Red Gold gave me nothing but fits.
Why?
Well, first of all, I had to do all the research in French. And here's the reason. Red Gold is about the fact that there was no French resistance until the French Communist Party came along. At the end of the war in 1945, there was very nearly a brutal civil war in France between the left and the right. It was just barely avoided, and thankfully avoided, because if the country was pretty badly screwed up, it would have been worse. So we then enter in the period of the Cold War. Meanwhile, the guys from the French Communist Party write their memoirs, especially the intelligence service of the French Communist Party, believe it or not, because they had one, and it was quite good and quite effective and was very prominent in the resistance. However, because I think of the Cold War, those books were never translated. So I had to go find them in French, buy them from France, have them sent to me, and do the research in that way. It was very, very curious. So that book started difficult, and it stayed difficult. I like the book. I think it's not so bad. But it did give me a harder time than some of the others.
Well, having read Red Gold a month after rather than a year and a half after, which is when it came out, I was able to see it at more as a piece, parts one and two of the same book. And to that degree, it works. Because the first, it's really a single story. It's the story of this one man's fight to come to grips with going from being an outsider and a bystander to being involved in the war.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And it's and by the way, tells the story of collaboration and resistance in France, which is a complicated story.
He has his ex-wife, her husband, is a collaborator.
Absolutely.
With the Nazis. And when we hear today about that, we hear nothing of the collaborators, except occasionally a novel will come out. It's a mystery novel by Cara Black, which was about collaborationists getting their just rewards 20 years after the fact. But other than that, we don't hear anything about it.
Well, that's because collaboration in France was a thing of fine degree. In The World at Night, Casson has lunch with his lawyer when he finally returns to Paris after serving in the military at the age of 42. And he says to his lawyer, well, what? He's a film producer, and he says, well, what am I supposed to do now? And the lawyer says to him, well, under occupation, what will your barber do? And Casson says, well, he'll cut hair. And his lawyer says, well, does that mean he's collaborating? And Casson thinks about it, and he says, well, I guess not. He says, no, writers will write novels. Producers will produce movies. Do you know who did your show? Your show? Under collaboration? This show, virtually, the cultural show in Paris in 1942 and 1943, the host was Simone de Beauvoir.
During the occupation?
Yes, absolutely. Camus' novel came out in 1942, The Stranger. In fact, the producer in The World at Night wants to buy it for the title. He likes the idea, L'Étranger. He sees it on a movie marquee. No, the French collaborated to a great degree, but they also, the other side of their nature, very unfortunately, because I think someone writing about it says that at the end of the war, they opened warehouses that the Gestapo had kept while they were in Paris and came upon what they described as mountains of denunciation. In other words, unopened, some of them, piles of letters that reached 15 feet in this huge warehouse as far as the eye could see. I mean, it was, they didn't do well. They broke, shall we say. They lost their soul by not fighting back.
But it's clear. You can see the transition, and this was one of the reasons why I call it more of a single novel, even though one might have been easy to write and one might have been hard and they were written apart. You see over the course of the two books the way collaboration takes your soul, and the way, as it comes out in the second book, it becomes more clear, where it's not really in the first, that the Nazi occupation is going to last indefinitely. We know it was over in 4 years. They didn't know that. For them, it could have been 20 years. So when you see the factory owner in the book who doesn't like the Nazis, and yet he's got a factory that's aiding the Nazis, what do you do?
What do you do? And furthermore, I think you really have to understand people in that era. The penalty for being in the resistance was very severe, and they weren't fooling around at all. They would catch you. They were quite capable of catching people and caught them all the time. There was no so-called marquee early in the war. That came after the Battle of Stalingrad, because what happened was, after Germany lost an army at Stalingrad and effectively lost the war, they had a manpower crisis. And so they started to draft French civilians into war work in Germany, and a lot of them wouldn't go. So they went out into the countryside, the brush, in French marquee, and so the legend, shall we say, or the myth of that particular part of the resistance begins to play a part. Now, frankly, by 1944, when it was clear who was going to win the war, the French were right there, and they were all armed, and they were all ready to go.
Of course, it's a different time, and you know, you always go with the winner. Look,
well, they did. You know? They did. And the French had a name for them. They called them naphtaline, which means mothballs.
That brings us in a roundabout way to the topic in Blood of Victory, because it raises the question, which is something that it's kind of been toying in the back of my head for a long time, and I've never quite understood this. Here was this one country, Germany. Not only does it conquer, and we know countries conquer, we see it happen all the time, but somehow through conquering, they're able to hold on to this empire for 4 years. How did they do it? How did they manage to do it when no one outside of Austria really wanted them there? Yet they somehow managed to do it. Now, obviously they needed oil, which is where Blood of Victory comes in, but something else must have been going on.
Well, first of all, you had a lot of fascists in Europe in that period, so that in countries like Norway and other, you know, France, you had willing fascists who would take over a puppet government. The only country in Europe that never had a puppet government was Poland. The Nazis governed Poland directly. They did not govern France directly. Vichy governed France. And in Norway, the Quisling individuals governed Norway. These people thought that the German or fascist domination of Europe would last for 300 years. After all, they were very familiar with 300-year empires. They were pretty common in 1940. The German Empire, the Russian Empire, and the Ottoman Empire had all died in 1918, but that's in recent memory in 1940. That's 22 years earlier. You know, for us, we're talking about 1978. That's the equivalent. So 300-year empires were nothing to them, and the British Empire still existed and did well, and now there was going to be a new German Empire. So they had no reason to think that in their own lifetime they would ever have to account for their behavior. They thought they were smart. We're going to go with the Germans here, and we're going to run the government of this country, and we're going to do what's right. Pétain in France believed that the French, by being immoral, having love affairs and drinking wine, had weakened themselves, and had weakened themselves to the point of losing that war, and now needed to be morally rebuilt as a nation so they could be triumphant and once again have an empire, which they had.
But that would mean that France would be under German control and maintain, you know, secondary status to Germany. It's kind of a curious, it's a dichotomy there. I mean, that they're going to rise, but they can't rise because Germany really controls them.
Well, their German friends helped them. Why is this less of an alliance than any diplomatic alliance in the world today? The people in Vichy were sorry they'd lost the war, but they were responsible for it, or the French were responsible for it, or the communists were responsible for it. And the only nation that stood up against Bolshevism was Germany, and Germany sold itself on that basis all the time, and it's in all my books. That's how they did this thing.
But that opens up something that happens in Blood of Victory. A major part of the book is, if Germany stood up against Bolshevism, you've got that curious phenomenon, which lasted, I think, a year, of the Stalin-Hitler peace pact.
Right.
Now, from the perspective of communists in America, the moment that happened, I know of a number of communists who said, to hell with it, and they walked away from the party at that moment.
Right.
But over there, how could it be dealt with? I know that your character, Sarabin, in Blood of Victory, is kind of bemused by it, but he has no illusions about Stalin. But throughout Western Europe, the Communist Party must have.
They felt in the Communist Party, the ones who stayed, that you were fooling yourself if you believed that anything with compassion could overcome Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler required an equally brutal force on the other end to defeat him, and that was, as we called him in America, Uncle Joe Stalin, that great guy who had already slaughtered 40 million people by before the war started. But he was then our ally.
But in that, there was a period when he made peace with Germany.
They made a peace of realpolitik as the two despised nations in Europe, as the two nations in Europe run by thugs who'd never gone to college, who were not part of the ruling class. You have to remember that both Hitler and Stalin came from the street, and that was totally different than any other leader in Europe at that time. The rest of them were all aristocrats one way or another, including in Britain.
So, and that's an aspect that we don't hear much about.
No, I don't think we hear much about it, because the politics of the period had people changing sides. And nobody had any illusions in Germany about the Russians, but they needed stuff that Russia had. They needed, one of the things Russia had they needed was oil. And the Russians needed German know-how, engineering, help with this and that and the other. Plus, they also had a secret agreement, aside from the pact on the surface, which basically under which they took Poland and divided it in half. They also had pacts starting in the middle of the 1930s. Now, under the Versailles Treaty, Germany was not allowed to have an air force. So they had air clubs, but they also had an air force people training in Russia. And they had tank people training in Russia. That's the way the treaty, I think it was Rapallo, specified. They had all kinds of things going on together, those two countries. They were in their way, they managed to get along quite well.
Alan, first, let's talk more specifically about some of the events in Blood of Victory.
Okay.
Now, I understand from a review, I haven't read all of your books. I can't give you, I don't know, or maybe my memory is lacking, but apparently one of the characters in Blood of Victory was a character from another book.
That's correct.
Which one is that?
That is a Hungarian former diplomat named Polanyi, who in Kingdom of Shadows was the Eminence Grise who directed the hero of that book to do all the things that were done in Kingdom of Shadow.
Kostika.
Yes.
Baron Kostika is an interesting character. Was there actually an industrialist who surreptitiously joined kind of the European resistance while keeping up his contacts like that?
I think there were a number of such people, including Germans, but doing it from Switzerland. But he is based in part, and his history is most assuredly based on the famous arms dealer Basil Zaharoff. And I might have used Zaharoff himself, except that he died in 1936, and I wanted it to be a fictional character because of some of the things he does later in the book. He has to be a fictional character. But his history is Zaharoff's history. And I mentioned Zaharoff in the same chapter, and the chapter is called System Z, so it's not like it's a big secret. I'm saying to my reader, if the reader is a historian, look at, it's Basil Zaharoff. Yes, you're absolutely right. That's who it is. I'm going to acknowledge it right here on page 232. However, we're using his biography. This is a historical novel. You know, it's fiction. You can do what you want. We're using his biography for another character. We hope he doesn't mind.